Hi, I'm Gil Headley, and I'm the proud sponsor of the Anatomy and Movement Channel. Welcome. Literally hundreds of thousands of us have gathered here to expand our experience of embodiment, and in so doing, evolve the embodied experience of our world. Regardless of our differences, and we have them, we all live out our lives in a body, and we're all connected by that shared experience. I've been developing integral anatomy for the past 25 years. I believe the human body is not a problem to be solved, but rather a gift to be received and explored. Integral anatomy is an approach to understanding the whole body, which emphasizes textural layers, continuities, and relationships. We notice differences not to create separation, but to appreciate that which unites us all. I'll be presenting here on the Anatomy and Movement Channel, as well as on the main stage, and I hope you'll join me to explore the heart of inner space. And for further study with me, check out my website, gilheadley.com. When you join my site, you'll automatically receive 3 free full-length courses because I'm on a mission to share what I've learned through my own deep exploration of the human form. And I'm certain that these courses will enhance and transform your own embodiment practice. I hope you enjoy the presentation.
I'm very excited to be here. I'm going to share my screen with all of you, mostly to keep me on track. All right. So we're going to be discussing anxiety and its role in movement. More accurately, how I should have titled this is, how does movement impact our relationship with the experience of anxiety? To be clear, movement is just one part of many things that affect our emotional state and how we feel. But I think it's an important part. And I hope by the end of this, you'll have a pretty clear idea of different ways, different entry points into the experience of anxiety, how you can help someone or yourself maybe experience anxiety a little bit differently, or experience your relationship with anxiety a little bit differently. To begin, close your eyes. If you're standing, maybe have a seat so that you feel comfortable and supported while your eyes are closed. And with your eyes closed, I want you to imagine that you're in a very dark room. So dark that if I waved my hand in front of your face, you wouldn't be able to see my hand. And I want you to imagine that you are required to get from where you stand right now in this very dark room all the way across the room as quickly as possible. As you start navigating the room, your hand bumps into something. And as your hand bumps into something, you kind of try to figure out what that is. You realize you have to go under this object, and you hope that, you know, eventually you can make it out the other side without hitting your head. You do that successfully. As you go, you notice you have to step over something. There's an actual step you have to step up on. And at some point, you reach this drop-off. Your left foot doesn't have anything to connect with. You pause. Remember, you're trying to get across the room as quickly as possible. As you pause, I want you to imagine what your imaginary self is experiencing. Do you feel relaxed or tense? Has your heart rate increased? Has your breathing increased? What's your physiological response to this situation? Now, imagine that someone has suddenly turned the lights on, and you can see that the drop-off is about 3 feet. You navigate your way down, you continue across the room, navigating the obstacles that are there until you successfully complete it. Again, still with your eyes closed, imagine what your imaginary self is experiencing physically now. Do you feel different than your imaginary self did with the drop-off that you couldn't see? If so, how do you feel different? Go ahead and open your eyes. This scenario was first given to me by one of my early exercise psychology professors. And this was something he actually did as part of his test for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. He really wanted to be an FBI agent right out of college. When he got to that drop-off point, he froze. He panicked. He was unable to complete the test And unfortunately, that was the end of his dream of being an FBI agent. And he gave us this scenario. He explained this to us to explain how, when we experience fear, how that changes how we move. And the thing with this is that was a stressful situation. When you look at something like anxiety, anxiety means that your baseline is always in the slightly elevated state. When you return to whatever your baseline is after the stressor has been removed, you don't quite feel calm. There's always something lurking in the background. There are many different types of anxiety, of course, and not all anxiety is generalized anxiety disorder or has been diagnosed by professionals. Some people experience anxiety on a very regular basis and they never seek professional help for it. And those are the people that typically come to see me. When you look at the role of chronic stress on movement patterns, you'll see three things that I think are really important, especially as from a movement professional standpoint. You will notice that breathing tends to be altered. So when we are experiencing stress, when you are experiencing maybe the hypothetical stress of the dark room situation, there's a good chance that your breathing changed in some way. Perhaps it increased, perhaps it became more shallow, perhaps you noticed that you had a difficult time feeling your torso for some reason. And this is common. Coordination then changes. So when your breathing changes, it suddenly impacts the way you're using your entire system. Your diaphragm doesn't perhaps move as much, or perhaps your ribs don't expand and contract as much because you're breathing more shallowly. When this happens, this changes your relationship between your rib cage and your pelvis. When this happens, that changes the relationship between all of the muscles that connect the whole torso to the extremities. And when this changes, that alters your experience of the ground. So we have these three things, and I am approaching it from the breathing changes the coordination and that changes the experience of the ground, but you could look at it a different way. You could say my experience of the ground has changed, which we'll see in a moment, and that is affecting my coordination and that is affecting my breathing and that is causing me a sensation of anxiety. I don't know which comes first, but they do seem to all play a role. I recently was referred a woman who came to me because she was having persistent discomfort. She had been a longtime yoga practitioner, very longtime yoga practitioner, and she always felt deeply connected with her body. For the last 11 years, a series of life events of chronic life stressors had taken her away from her yoga practice. She no longer felt connected to her body. These stressors were significant. They caused a lot of life changes for her. And she was finally ready to get back to some sort of movement practice. But every time she tried to start, she found herself injured or completely disconnected. And she was frustrated. As I watched her talk and as I watched her move, I noticed that her ribs were elevated. Her neck muscles were taut. She was having a hard time taking a deep breath. When she gestured to where she felt disconnected, it was completely throughout the entire core of her body. And when I asked her if she ever thought about how her feet interacted with the ground, she said, no, not really. I don't notice my feet. I notice just this big disconnect between my shoulders to my pelvis. As I had her start moving, I had her start feeling the middle back against the floor, doing some things in supine, because kinesthetic feedback can be really powerful for helping people feel parts of themselves. Her ribs still weren't moving, but at least I could see that she was starting to connect with different parts of her body. I had her do some really gentle isometric strength-based work to start to feel the muscles that supported her. And then I had her work on her feet a little bit, feel the way the feet pressed into the floor. as these things happened, I saw her start to, and it's really interesting because you will see this with people. I saw her start to come down a little bit. It's almost like she was starting to trust the floor a little bit more. Finally, because her ribs still weren't moving, her xiphoid process was still very, very stuck. I had her imagine, and you guys can try this if you'd like, that there was a pendulum about 10 inches in front of her xiphoid process. And every time the pendulum moved, her xiphoid process followed it. And within that, I'm going to take my camera down a little bit so you guys can see. Oh, still can't see. So whenever the pendulum moved, her xiphoid process moved. And as she did that, as she imagined that her xiphoid process was following this pendulum, I saw her start to connect even more. And I saw an even deeper connection within the rib cage and a softening. And that softening was kind of the final piece. We finished up with a couple more things. And as we finished, I asked her how she felt. She looked a little bit emotional and she said to me, she said, you know, this is the first time I've felt myself in 11 years. And it gives me hope that I don't have to feel so disconnected and like I'm living in this heightened state all of the time. And this again is just the value. This is just an illustration of the concepts that I'm going to discuss right now of using movement to create an environment that invites a softening. So how do these things work? How can movement influence anxiety? Well, the first way is through interoception. And interoception is your internal sense of what's happening physiologically. And this can be a lot of different things. So your interoception is your sensation of your breath, your sensation of your heart rate. The researchers debate this, but maybe the sensation of your muscles or the sensation of discomfort or the sensation of nerve pain or the sensation of hunger or the sensation of being tired. All of those things are your interoception. And the thing with interoception is it is a sense. Just like your visual system, just like your auditory system, just like your touch, your sense of touch. So that means that it's happening all of the time, whether or not you're aware of it. What research has shown that often happens with people who have symptoms of anxiety that are persistent is that their interoceptive awareness might be heightened. They're acutely aware of what's happening internally, but their interoceptive accuracy is a little bit mismatched. So what's actually happening, so yes, they might be experiencing an increase in heart rate, but their perception of why that is happening might be something like, oh my gosh, I'm having a panic attack or a heart attack, which I think many of us have probably experienced this. It's like when you're trying to go to sleep and you're thinking, oh my gosh, I really need to get to sleep. And then that makes the sleep become harder and more elusive to find. When you start to think, oh my gosh, my heart rate's increasing, there must be something wrong. That makes the heart rate increase even more. So creating a more accurate perception of what's happening internally can be really beneficial for people who have anxiety. And one way to do this is actually with cardiovascular activity. So cardiovascular activity does the very thing that might be anxiety provoking. It causes an increase in heart rate. It causes an increase in respiration rate. But the cool thing about cardiovascular activity is when you stop, these things return to a baseline. So it creates contrast. So suddenly the person who maybe is unsure of what these body signals mean, or they fear that these body signals mean the worst, they start to see, oh, that's interesting. This sensation that I experience when I run or when I go for a walk or whatever it is the same as the sensation I feel when I'm about to talk at the embodiment conference. And I'll be fine. It's not that big a deal to experience those sensations. So that's one theory behind why cardiovascular exercise works. for people with anxiety. There are definitely hormonal reasons as well. There's an increase in BDNF uptake. BDNF is a neutrophil, which facilitates the firing together of neurons, which facilitates learning. And this is really valuable, especially actually with depression, where you see a little less of the BDNF being utilized, but with anxiety too. There's increases in dopamine and serotonin, and all of these things make you feel just a little bit happier and a little bit better about life. The next aspect of movement that can influence anxiety is actually strength training. And the research on this is in its infancy. So there's not that many studies, but there have been a couple of systematic reviews, and they both overwhelmingly show that when someone with anxiety symptoms goes through a strength-based exercise program that leads to increases in strength, their symptoms related to the physical symptoms related to anxiety decrease. And again, I think this is valuable. I think this is often completely ignored. A number of reasons this could be happening. Interoception is one of them. If you've ever done sets of deadlifts, one of the things you notice when you set the heavy bar down is it's after you set the heavy bar down that your heart rate and your breathing suddenly, they spike. They go pretty high up. But just as quickly as they go up, they go right back down. So you start to get this contrasted interoceptive gradient and awareness. It also increases your proprioception. Your proprioception is your unconscious awareness of where your body is located in space. It's, again, a sense, like these other things that I talked about a moment ago. It's always happening, even if you're not focusing on it. But again, when you look at people who experience anxiety on a regular basis, there does seem to be a correlation between poor proprioception and anxiety type symptoms. You particularly see this in the hypermobile set. And I shouldn't say that like that. I should actually say you particularly see that in people with benign joint hypermobility syndrome or other forms of EDS, which is a genetic disorder that causes hypermobility in the ligaments. And one of the speculations for that is if you aren't getting accurate information about where your body is in space, because the ligaments are unable to give the brain that accurate information, then you feel a little unsure of your body and its capabilities and your options for movement. Finally, strength training creates a sense of physical strength, and that does seem to translate directly to emotional strength, which is, again, I think pretty fascinating. The final way movement can influence anxiety is through enriched environments. And the research on this has been primarily done with learning. So if you look at children or you look at animal models, when they are placed in environments that feel safe and where they can interact with the environment, that creates the ability to learn more freely. And when we have the ability to learn more freely, the theory is coming about that perhaps that downregulates the nervous system. And an enriched environment can be a lot of things. Yes, it can be toys, it can be, you know, the outside. If you spend time outside, the natural environment is definitely an enriched environment. But other things can contribute to an enriched environment too. The people in the environment can create an enriched environment. Interacting with someone can definitely make an environment more enriched. And if you work with people at all in a one-on-one environment or in a workshop type environment, or you've ever been an attendee in either of those settings, you've probably noticed that the presence of the person that you're with has a direct impact on your energy and your mood. Enriched environments can involve things like noise stimulus. So if music is playing in the background that you really enjoy, that can definitely enrich an environment. What does the environment look like? all of these things play into your experience and how you move. So when you are putting yourself in a situation where you're going to be moving, especially if it's new, if the movement piece is new, if you look for an environment where you feel comfortable and that seems to be enriching in some way, chances are high your relationship with that experience will be very rewarding and it will regulate you in some way. One of the things enriched environments tend to do, which I think is, again, just really cool, is they provide options, opportunities for dynamic balance. And there is a direct correlation between poor balance and higher anxiety type symptoms in children, the elderly, and animal models. Here's the thing with this. They have not studied anybody between the, well, to my knowledge, they have not done any studies with people between the ages of 25 and 55. We're just kind of left out of the whole thing. But we know that there's this correlation between children and the elderly and animals between their anxiety and balance. So it would stand to reason there's probably some sort of correlation with the rest of us. There was a, what intrigued me about all of this, years ago, I stumbled across a study that looked at mice that were bred to have very poor balance. And what they did with these mice was they put them, they separated them into two groups. One group went into a cage where they could climb and there were things to climb and there were things to hang from. There were balance beams to balance across. The other group of mice was put just in a regular cage. After a set amount of time, they looked at these mice and their anxiety, and they measure mice anxiety with various tests. They give them these tests and they see how they respond, like maze tests and things. And what they found with these mice were the ones that were in a regular cage, their anxiety levels were really high. The group that was in the enriched environment, not only was their balance a whole lot better, their anxiety was nil. So how cool is that, right? That you can change these things by placing the mice in the enriched environment. And this, I think, from a movement standpoint, makes a lot of, when you're thinking about a movement intervention, it's important to think about trying things that might be a little outside your comfort zone. This is where things like parkour or dance or MoveNat can be really valuable. And you don't have to be out vaulting. You can do something just as you know, gentle as standing on a 2x4 to see how that goes. The 2x4 suddenly becomes really interesting. My clients comment on this all the time. They're like, you go to the lumbar store, you pay like 10 bucks, you come back with these things, you have us do all these things, and they're so much more interesting than just some of the regular gym equipment. So you can create an environment for very little money that feels very enriched if you're creative. If you want, you guys can try this if you want. So if you were to stand up, or you can stay seated, I'll give you a seated option as well. And I want you to look around the room and I want you to find three things in your room that are interesting. Doesn't matter where they're located, just find three things that you're like, huh, I haven't really looked at that in that way before. Once you've identified those three things, if you're seated, begin seeing how close you can get your left hand to each of the three things. If you're standing, see how close you can get your left foot to each of the three things. And really try to reach for that object. Really see if you can get to it, whether you're using your foot or your hand. And after you've tried the left side, try the right side. How close can you get to each of these three objects? And once you've tried that, you can relax. So you've suddenly interacted with your environment, probably in a way that you haven't really considered before. You've also challenged your balance. Even if you were seated and you're thinking to yourself, I didn't really feel like that challenged my balance, it threw your center off a little bit to reach for the object. Your center has to shift. We're going to talk about this more in a moment, but it is an aspect. So what are our goals? So if we look at this information and we say, okay, so I need to be strong. I need to get some sort of cardiovascular activity and I need an enriched environment. Pick just one. You don't need to pick all three. And whatever it is that you pick, see if you can find an aspect of multisensory integration. The more of yourself you can feel, the more of yourself you can use. The more of yourself that receives input from the environment, the more calm and secure you feel, assuming the environment is safe. If the environment isn't safe, that is a different thing. You need to find a safe environment if you want to start playing with these things. And it can be something as simple. I don't know if any of you have ever walked into, if you ever walk into a hardcore weightlifting gym, often the walls are stark white. There's rubber matting on the floor not my thing. There's not usually very many windows, and there's really loud music playing in the background. So one of the things I did when I opened my space is I have pretty natural wood floors. I have a ton of natural light and I play more mellow music in the background, which can be pluses or minuses there. But you can find, if you really look for it, an environment where you feel safe. And if you don't feel safe in one environment, find a different environment. What you find feels safe is going to feel different than what I find feels safe. And in the era of COVID, where so many of us are trying to create movement spaces at home, we can create a movement space that feels safe and that feels enriched in some way. People love to put themselves in their garage to work out, which I think is fine as long as there's some, you've got something in there that's visually pleasing in some way. We don't have to suffer to address some of these issues. So what about when exercise is part of the problem? With which, yes, this can absolutely happen. And you may or may not have met the person who's a little bit amped up already. And that person is also does cycle bar 6 days a week and does CrossFit 4 days a week and is doing all this other stuff. They clearly don't know how to down-regulate. They're using the exercise to stay in this elevated sympathetic state. So there's a nervous system imbalance. Often there's an avoidance of connecting with the physical self. And if you work a lot with people with anxiety, you'll find a lot of them are extremely intelligent top-down processors, which means they think about everything here. They don't experience everything through the rest of themselves. So the goal, at least my goal, as a movement practitioner, is to create variance in the physical and the emotional experience. How can I create contrast? This person lives up here. How can I start to create contrast so they start to feel what it's like to be down here? And this doesn't always mean restorative yoga. Restorative yoga is great, but for some of us, myself included, lying down on the floor for an hour doesn't always downregulate me. It makes me more anxious. So we have to find other avenues in, right? For some people, like I said, it'll be great. They'll lie down on the floor, they'll take a nap, it'll be awesome. So what's the solution in this situation? You can intersperse moderate and low intensity movement that requires focused attention. And what I mean by this is when you give people a task that is going to require them to slow down, their nervous system is going to have to come with them a little bit or they're not going to be successful at the task. So one of the things I use fairly frequently with clients of actually all ages is the Jenga blocks. If you know what Jenga blocks look like, they're these little wooden blocks. And you take a Jenga block vertically, you balance another one on top horizontally, you place one in each hand, and you make the goal to keep the blocks even. Don't let one hand get higher than the other. And then you ask the person to do various tasks. Can you walk around the room? Pretty easy entry point. It'll start to focus them. It'll slow them down because they'll be focused on trying to keep the Jenga blocks even. If they're successful with that, great. Can you stand on one leg? Again, focused attention. If one starts to fall, they'll correct themselves. If they feel themselves getting a little amped up, they will naturally downregulate in order to accomplish the task, as long as they find the task interesting and you safe. Can you sit down on, I usually have plyo boxes. Can you sit down on the plyo box? Can you stand up? Can you sit down on the floor? All of these types of tasks are ways to slow the person down and focus attention. And you can do this with so many things. It does not have to be just this Jenga block exercise. We did that with reaching around the room. I imagine you probably went a little slower than you would have had I not said, really try to touch. The external focus is very good for the monkey brain. You can have people pick things up and set them back down. I can't tell, I have one client in particular who tends to run a little bit on the, a little bit high on the anxiety spectrum. And when she comes in really worked up, I always have her do a little bit of balance work, but then I also have her do things like, all right, you're going to pick up all of these things that are in really strange places around the room by standing on one leg or by lunging or whatever it is. And I watch as suddenly she goes from up here to down here. So again, lots of entry points in. The other ways to start to accomplish more down regulation, if you're looking at your movement practice as a broader context, is to make sure you have elements of grounding. And by grounding, I mean that you feel the support of the floor. This can be done many ways. If any of you are taking, like any of Marlo Fiskin, I know, is teaching, and Ryan Hurst are teaching, I think they're both teaching later this weekend. Both of them use a lot of groundwork. You will be on the floor. You will be rolling around. This is very down-regulating, even though the movements might be hard, because you can feel more of yourself. You're suddenly increasing your proprioception, which is giving you more feedback. And because many of these movements are task-based, attention is focused. But there's other ways to ground too. So you can do this with me if you'd like. If you're seated, you can stay seated, or you can come into a standing position. Whichever one you choose, I want you to feel the surface of the floor. And as you feel the surface of the floor, I want you to observe if you're lifting away from the floor or you're letting yourself sink into the floor. Don't try and change anything. Just observe what your natural state is right now. Once you have that clearly in your mind, begin lifting the insides of your feet away from the floor and then the outsides of your feet away from the floor. Lift the insides of the feet, lift the outsides of the feet. Now, as you do this, I want you to really focus on how the heel rolls against the floor as you roll the inside of the feet away from the floor and the outside of the feet away from the floor. Just really focus on that sensation of the heels. Now shift your awareness to the balls of the feet. Feel how the weight changes when you lift the inside of the foot away from the floor and then the outside of the foot. Just go back and forth there. Now slow it down until you find a place where it feels like the center of your heels are against the floor and the balls of the feet are even against the floor. And I want you to imagine that you're reaching from the outside of the heels all the way to the pinky toe sides of the foot. It's like that area of your foot's getting really long. And I want you to imagine that you're reaching from the inside of the heel all the way to the big toe side of the foot. It's like that area is getting really long. And once you have that, begin bending your knees and sinking into the feet. And then just straightening your knees. And just go back and forth a few times here. Just feeling the weight of yourself as your knees bend, as your feet receives it. Now find a place where it feels like you're standing comfortably. And like you did a moment ago, I simply want you to observe your connection with the floor and whether you feel the floor is supporting you. And maybe you contrast this with how you felt a moment ago. Did something change? And then go ahead and come back into a comfortable seated position if you're not already. So grounding can be done, like I said, anyway. You can do it in any position, but really what grounding is the ability to feel the points of contact with the floor and trust the floor. If you don't trust the floor, it's very difficult to trust yourself during movement. The next way to bring, again, if you're looking at this from a broader context, is to have an element of centering in your practice. And centering can actually be, again, a lot of different things. There are so many ways to find center. I know for me, for instance, just like a front squat can really be centering. I'm like, yes, I feel exactly where the center of my body is. And for those of you that aren't sure of where the center of your body is, for most of us, it is located at the level of the second sacral vertebrae. So it's, if you go to your belly button and you slide two or three fingers down, it's right about there. If you're really long torsoed, it might be a little lower, but that's the general place where the center of your body is. And if your breathing, as I mentioned earlier, is altered because you're living in this chronic state of fight or flight, that is going to take you away from your center. So finding center is really empowering and gives you a better sense of proprioceptively where your body is in space. You can also do things like any sort of swaying will help someone find center. The basic idea is if you move away from center, it makes it easier to find center. When you create contrast, it starts to become easier to find the middle. So again, you guys can join me on this if you'd like. You can either stay seated or you can stand. I will offer a modification for seated. If you're seated, go ahead and find your sitting bones against the chair and find your feet against the floor. If you're standing, find your feet against the floor. And I want you to let the rest of you be as just soft as possible. It's like you're not holding, you can even shake your arms out a little bit. Like you're not holding any tension anywhere else. And begin gently rocking. If you're seated, begin gently rocking to your right sitting bone and then to your left sitting bone. Just rock. Let the rest of you respond. If you're standing like I am, just rock from foot to foot. One foot might lift or it might not. There's no right or wrong here. And I like to imagine that I'm like a tree branch just kind of swaying in the wind when I do this. Now start to slow down the rocking. Make it super small. And then find a place where it feels like you are actually centered. Once you find that place, take your hands. You're gonna pretend like you're holding a small ball and you're gonna take your hands right below your belly button. So you're holding a small ball right below your belly button. You're gonna use your inhale to make the ball bigger and use your exhale to make the ball smaller. And you're doing this right below your belly button. Your breath is moving your hands to change the shape of the ball. Take two more breaths for me, please. And when you finish,
if I could interrupt you real quick.
Yes.
We've had a request to see you do the movements for non-English speakers. They aren't quite following some of the movements. And we want to do questions in about 3 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, that's totally fine. We're right on top with that. Is it okay if I do the movements at the end? Because then I can move my camera just once.
Yes, brilliant. Just wanted to let you know that That was requested.
Perfect, no problem. All right. So, as I said, centering can be done a lot of different ways. And hopefully when you finished that, you were a little more clear on where your sense of center was. There's no right or wrong with these concepts. It's just a matter of playing with them. And the more you play with them as a practitioner or as a student, the more options you have and the more clear it becomes. And finally, there's breathing. So as I said, breathing can sometimes actually really stress anxious people out. So it's not always the first place I go. I usually wait and introduce breathing a little bit later. But one thing I always do check in with is, does the person breathe while they move? When they're introduced to a stressful situation, when I ask someone to stand on a 2x4, do they hold their breath? If they do, I simply bring their awareness to it. I say, can you feel that you're holding your breath? And they almost always say, oh yes, I always do that. There, I just go ahead and try and exhale and breathe. And usually that pattern will show up in other places. So that's the first entry point to breathing. The next entry point to breathing might be breathing into an object or making it task-based, like I just did with the hands. Using the breath to move the hands is, for a lot of people, a lot less stressful than lying down on your back and trying to count the length of your inhale and count the length of your exhale. Though eventually it's good to be able to do that too. And then again, it just sort of progresses. So again, many options for breathing. The other thing you guys can play with is the idea, often I'll put like a blanket underneath someone's mid-back and I'll ask someone to breathe into the blanket. Or if you've ever used one of those rubber balls, I'll place it underneath the belly and I'll ask someone to breathe into the rubber ball. It's just reminding the person there's lots of ways to breathe. They don't always have to breathe up here. And then maybe eventually it gets to, can you exhale and pause? Because if you study the nervous system, you will notice that what comes up over and over again is exhaling. Long exhales activate the parasympathetic nervous system and inhales activate the sympathetic nervous system. So with that, I'm actually to the question portion, which hopefully is right on time. And I will demonstrate, I'm gonna unplug my mic and unplug my AirPods and move my mic down to show the movements for people that were curious about those. And then I will come back. So let's move me down. Let's see, I think, hopefully. Okay, I'm gonna move my camera down one more time so you can see the foot situation. So what I was doing with the feet was simply lifting the insides of the feet and then lifting the outsides of the feet. So that was all there. And then I bent the knees and straightened them. And then with the hands, so the swaying, I just swayed from side to side. And with the hands, it was just inhale to expand, exhale to get smaller. So hopefully that made sense. All right, and then.
All right, excellent, Jen, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, we're gonna go ahead and ask a few questions then.
Great.
Let's see. Our first question, our number one question is, which comes first, the anxiety or the unhealthy movement patterns? Like, is it a chicken and egg? Is it both ways?
It's totally a chicken and egg. It's impossible to know.
Okay. That's a tough one.
It is, you know, and usually by the time somebody again, presents with me and probably with a lot of you, if any of you here are movement practitioners, they've got both the anxiety and the poor movement pattern, right? So you pick the thing that you know how to do. And for me, it's always, okay, let's do the movement pattern.
Yeah. And for everyone watching, don't forget to go into the Q&A and vote up the questions that you would like to see asked, because there are multiple questions. All right. And our next highest question right now, Kaz has asked, I have EDS and kinesiophobia partially due to what you're speaking about and partially due to a long history of being stranded with EDS related injuries. Do you have any recommendations for how people like me can treat the kinesiophobia? My physical therapist is not familiar, nor is my therapist. That's pretty specific to the EDS. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So the thing with it is you want to use, so the concept is graded exposure therapy. And what that means is you start with the smallest dose possible. And when that goes okay, then you start to increase the dosage. And the hard part with EDS is it's very person specific. I would strongly recommend, if you're not working with someone really familiar with EDS, to work with someone familiar with EDS, because unfortunately, the people that know it really well, but there's a lot of people that don't know it. And the kinesiophobia piece is huge, but you can, like I had one woman that I literally, we just worked on lifting the heel and lowering the heel down. And that was like her first round. And it was really hard for her. She had all kinds of things happening. But once she got that, we could move into other things slowly, very slowly.
Brilliant. Jen, could you please turn off the screen share? People want to see you.
Oh yeah. Stop share. There we go.
Excellent. And let's see, our next question then is, have you worked with women who are anxious because of hormonal changes or problems related to cycle, especially peri-premenopausal issues? And would you basically approach anxiety no matter the source with the same kind of movements, including those who already have good proprioception, who are normally not so anxious? I guess that was a big one.
So often with those individuals, they actually respond really well to the breathing work. So again, like this is all kind of that, you know, what does the person need? And with hormonal changes, it can really impact your sleep cycle. So a big part of that, I always ask those clients as well, how's your sleep? And if I can give them any sort of down regulating breath work or tiny little movement work that'll calm them down before bed that might help them sleep better, that's generally what we go with. But yeah, that gets tricky. And then two, I do find that making sure the cardiovascular activity is consistent does help as well.
Excellent. Our next question, do you see dizziness, vertigo with mm-hmm. people with anxiety? And then how do you manage that when you see it?
Yes, and it depends on the source of the vertigo. So if someone actually has, the name of which is escaping me, where one crystal is actually out of place of the ear and that's what's causing the symptoms related to vertigo, then I have to be really careful with head position. I have one woman who can't do any eye work because that triggers vertigo. So you start to learn ways to work around it. You know, I'll have people do things like keep your head straight, turn your body around your head, because that stimulates turning the head, but in a different way. The head stays fixed, you're turning the body around the head. That starts to create, again, a sense of safety within the movement. So then maybe you can start to do different things within it. You, instead of dropping the head down to come to the floor, you teach people, you know, can you keep your head level as you start to slowly descend down? You give them props so they can get down there safely. So you start to work with level changes, you start to work with things that require turning of the head. You maybe, if person doesn't have eye-triggered vertigo, you work with tennis ball stuff, follow the ball to start to get some of that. And then gradually you might work towards rocking movements on the floor that are not big, that are small. Same thing, graded exposure therapy. How small can I make this so that it feels safe for the person? Can I build upon that?
Excellent. Excellent. Let's see. I think we got time for more. We have a question here that says, is trusting the floor related to feeling safe? And are there any recommendations if I have problems with it?
They absolutely, and it's really interesting. If you're on the floor and you ask yourself, do I feel supported? And that triggers something for you, then that's generally an indicator that something about the floor doesn't feel safe or something about support doesn't feel safe. And you can work with that. So you can start to play with, well, okay, what position on the floor do I feel supported? Do I feel most supported? What position on the floor starts to let me feel supported? And does this give me an increased sense of safety? And the increased sense of safety will come with the downregulation of the nervous system. So you start to tune in, well, how's my breathing? How's my heart rate? Do I notice a change? If I notice a change, I'm on the right track. So that's how you kind of play with that.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question with about a 1 minute answer.
Okay.
And let's see, the next one is, I lead movement programs for people with physical disabilities. Awesome. And also another group with cancer. They are disconnected from their bodies for many reasons. Would these principles apply for these populations?
Yes. Oh my goodness, yes. If you can get them to feel more of themselves, if you can get them to play with dynamic balance, they will feel empowered. It's very rewarding actually to work with those groups and to see some of those changes.
Excellent. Outstanding, Jen. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. We're going to come back to you at the very end for your final tip on your top embodiment tip, basically. But for more, we're going to put in some links for everybody. And if you would like to continue this discussion that we're having, please join us on the Embodiment Conference Facebook page. Or on the portal for our coffee breaks. And once again, we want to thank our sponsor for the channel, Dr. Gil Headley. Thank you very much, doctor. And I also personally want to say thanks, Jen. That was fantastic. Remember, everybody, if you need a little bit more time to digest these things, because there's a lot that we go over, You can buy the library, and that's a great way to take your time and process these things and really make them a part of you, make them a part of your practice. And it's a great way to say thank you to our speakers and our organizers. And it's also a very nice thing because when people buy the library, that's how we're able to do all of this for free. So you enable someone else to get the chance to embody these things that might not be able to afford it on their own. So lots of reasons to check out the library and really embody these principles. And let's see, we got all of our links and everything. Awesome. Yeah, please join us. And also, I also want to mention that to really dig into what Jen's doing, she has several books available that we have pasted into our chat as well. So thank you, everybody. And we're going to give one last minute to Jen to give us your top embodiment tip, please.
Explore movement. You know, pick a movement that you know really, really well, or you think you know really well, and start to play with the nuances. What's there? What are you missing? Because when you start to play with the nuances and you really start to get to know a movement really, really well, it starts to translate into your life. You know, if I can find the nuance there, I can find the nuance in the way I communicate. I can find the nuance in the way I interact. And to me, that's really valuable.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Jen, thank you very much. And we look forward to seeing everybody in the coffee rooms and on the Facebook page. And once again, Jen, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.